discussion here for now. Everybody was nicely on time, and so we do have plenty of time here for some questions in general before we move to the second half of the session, where we'll perhaps try to get more into a dialogue and discussion. But here's your opportunity. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I have a question just for educational purposes. I think wind is about 12 or 20 miles offshore, but it's only like, whatever, 60, 80, 100 feet deep. Whereas the project you just talked about is 12 miles offshore, 500 something feet deep. Cape Wind's fixed, I guess, and this is technology involved in implementing both of those scenarios. Why you would pick, you know, offshore single tube as opposed to closer in shallow water fixed?
So I think there's a number of reasons why we believe in deep water technology. I think the first reason is that you can have more flexibility on where you put the turbines. Up until now, the industry has been dependent on reasonably shallow water. That's why you see the turbines close to shore. You have had some issues and discussions on visibility, conflicts with fisheries, etc. We see that when you have the technology available, you can actually put the turbines further out where you cannot see them, and there's less conflicts of use. The other reason why we believe in floating technology is also the cost issue. We believe that developing floating wind can be done in a very cost-efficient way. You don't have that complex marine installation operations, so we believe that this is an energy source that can be developed cost competitively.
So what you mean is putting pilings in the bottom and those kinds of infrastructure are both costly.
But we look at both as a company. It's important to underline. We do shallower water sites in Europe, and we'll continue doing that. But for us, this is about having technology available to use whichever technology makes sense at the site you have.
Then why would you use floating, say, at Cape Wind as opposed to Cape Wind?
Well, at the Cape Wind side, it's too shallow, so then you use the shallow water technology.
I think the other thing, just to add, that when we looked at the wind resource in the Gulf of Maine, the best wind resources are further out in deeper water, and you're farther away from other users as well. And as Kristen said, I think the real economic advantage, just to further what she introduced, is that if you can build it onshore, you can do it for a lot less money than if you're trying to build it out there. So you don't have the jack-up barges, you're not working in that marine environment. So if you can imagine you wanted to build a new boat, you wanted to build it while you were floating versus building it in a nice warm heated shed on land. The challenges of building out the marine environment are harsh and expensive. The more you can do it on land, tow it out, put it where you invest in, optimize it for wind, the advantages are all there.
Questions? Sir? Christine, I don't understand the hydrodynamics of the principle. If it's floating and the blades start moving, doesn't it tip backwards and screw up?
That's a very good question. Yes.
The blades?
It's a very good question, and it's the intelligence of this structure. So we have been developing this concept for over 10 years internally in Statoil. This was one of the first things our researchers looked at. When you have a structure and it's exposed to wind, you get all kind of movements. And they developed an intelligent way of pitching the blades, which really stabilizes the structure and makes sure that the power production is constant. So this is one of the very important features of this technology.
So what happens if one of the chains breaks? Does that end up on the Cape Cod?
No.
What happens?
We have redundancy systems. That's a short answer to prevent that things will happen.
A question for Statoil. It's been on my mind forever since we've been talking to Jake and all this offshore wind stuff. I'm a sailor, and these people are mainly offshore people. I think we've all experienced more than once the wind shears that happen when the highs come down and the lows come up. I mean, the wind can change direction in high velocity in a heartbeat. I've been knocked flat enough times, you know, experience, and I'm sure everybody else. And I always wondered, how do these turbines react that quick to that dramatic a change? 180-degree wind change.
Yeah, I think we have experienced some of those conditions in Norway during the test period, and I think in very harsh weather, all you want to do, the turbine to do, is to survive. Mm-hmm. So when it's, you know, blowing, as I said, 40 meters per second, the turbine, the power production shuts down, but we have proven that it doesn't harm the structure. So when the wind switches direction smoothly, it adapts, and you get a good power production. I think in winds like you are describing, we have shown that the structure doesn't take damage from the power.
Okay. Thank you.
Back in the room. Are there any other structures that have to go out there in the same area as the wind turbine to support, or equipment, anything like that, that also would be out there with them that you don't know about?
Well, not permanently, but we will be needing boats to access the turbines for maintenance purposes. So that will be part of the program.
We'll at our test site, we'll have some med ocean, at least one med ocean fully mounted LiDAR system as well, so we can reflect that data.
Final sale notices for those. We're actually waiting the conclusion of our ESA consultations and our EFH consultations for those areas.
And so it's a process question. At what point does it become too late to introduce those best practices that you referred to? I mean, the mitigation measures. I'm talking to some of the fishermen. I've been telling you, I've been talking to some of the fishermen in the UK who are working closely with the wind power companies, and they have very complex working relationships that cost the wind power company to maintain. And when does that get introduced? And I mean, one would think that the terms of the final lease might be what the developer would base his business plan on from that point on. So that's why I mentioned.
Well, just to sort of back up to your first question and then answer the second. You said something to the effect that these areas are way ahead of where we are with Statoil in the Gulf of Maine. And it sort of gets to the question of process. When we are having a competitive lease sale, we are offering that area for a lease for... And an environmental assessment has been done for those areas for site characterization and site assessment purposes. Once we have that competitive lease sale and a lease is issued, so say for example, if we do manage to hold that lease sale offshore Virginia in 2013. The winner of that lease has a five-year period for which they can come in with a construct to do their site data characterization, site assessment, and come in with a construction and operations plan. That construction operations plan, when they come in with that, will go through an additional environmental impact NEPA process, so that there can be, in addition to the lease terms that were issued at the issuing of the lease, there can be additional terms issued during the construction operations plan phase. And so there's a to get to Brian's development and working with the communities in terms of best management practices, that's going to be an ongoing process, but what he has identified and is working on now and coming up with final practice or a final report on all these workshops, there is time to implement and modify and adapt those over the next several years as we get to folks coming in with actual construction and operation plans for specific projects. Now here with the Statoil pilot project, you can correct me, Kristen, but your proposal is to move directly to a construction and operations plan. And so that will go through its environmental, its NEPA process when it comes into the agency and we start looking at it. When that happens, so going back to your original surmise, it doesn't mean that, say, offshore Virginia or offshore Rhode Island, Massachusetts, that those areas are necessarily far ahead of where you are here in the Gulf of Maine with this particular project. Is that
the time period then, the time period when the developer will develop those relationships with the local fishing industry will happen as part of that 5-year window after they receive the, after they've done their initial vetting?
Simplify it real quick. So we have the on the other process, not necessarily Statoil's process, but for the processes where we've identified the wind energy areas and we have the proposed sale notices, there will be eventually a lease issuance. But it's there's the 5 years that they have to submit a construction. There's a site assessment plan that's supposed to be submitted soon after that. That has a 5-year term. And then after that 5 years, then we receive a construction operations plan. Yeah, so they do have that full 5 years between the lease and when we expect to see a construction operations plan to do additional outreach. And it's not until we receive that construction operations plan that we then have the ability to say, okay, we're going to approve this, but with these terms and conditions, or if there are no terms and conditions, we approve as is.
It doesn't take 5 years to do that plan.
Yeah, no, they can submit it sooner.
They can submit it sooner. Yeah. And the other thing to add on is that we don't just say issue the lease and say we'll see you in 5 years. I mean, we hope that and we expect that once we issue a lease that we would have an ongoing dialogue as to what their intentions are, the data they're gathering, information gaps that they may be trying to fill in or that we identify that they should fill in during that time so that when they do end up coming in with an official plan for a specific project, that we do try to get to that the fullest set of information possible.
So I think we have just enough time to watch the ORPC video as we finish this session, and then we'll break and come back for more discussion. So if that's okay, I'm going to cue this up. Is there audio to it?
There is.
For those of you who came into the session late, Nate Johnson has spoken to us about the developments and tidal power down in Copsewood Bay, and he had brought this video along.
And the thing I would just make a note of for people is to take a look at most of the marine assets in the installation. It's pretty typical of what you would see as marine applications. Go ahead. Well, that's. I think this is just gives a real good visual of some of the marine assets and some of the construction activities that actually took place during the installation of a reverse horizon.
Systems and eco-conscious projects that harness the power of oceans and rivers to generate clean, predictable, renewable electricity. The turbine generator unit, or TGU, is a core component of all ORPC power systems. The TGU works on the same time-tested principle as a paddle wheel, using the force of moving water to turn turbine coils and power an underwater generator. In 2012, I'm very proud to say that the ORPC team built and is now operating the first commercial grid-connected licensed tidal energy project in America. In fact, it's the first licensed grid-connected ocean energy project of any kind that doesn't involve a dam in the Americas.
Tidal energy has arrived in America, and it landed right here in Eastport and Lubbock, Maine.
The first order of business in preparing for the installation of the Cobscombe Bay Tidal Energy Project was to assemble the bottom support frame that secures the Tigen TGU to the ocean floor. This happened at Perry Marine and Construction's facility in Eastport.
I want to congratulate ORPC on the successful development of an exciting new hydropower technology that is clean, predictable, renewable, while protecting the environment. ORPC has really been a pioneer in the hydrokinetic industry, and that is not an easy task to take on to be the first.
Our Cobscombe Bay project is licensed by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the state of Maine. The project is the first phase of the larger Maine Tidal Energy Project, which will include future devices to be installed in Cobscombe Bay and nearby Western Passage. ORPC has received approval from the Maine Public Utilities Commission for long-term power purchase agreements to sell up to 5,000 kilowatts per hour of tidal power from these sites, enough to power over 100 homes. This historic decision by the PUC, a first in the U.S. for ocean energy, is vital to the commercialization of tidal energy in Maine and underscores our industry leadership in the U.S. and abroad. It also formally recognizes the substantial economic benefits of tidal energy, which ORPC has already demonstrated in creating or retaining over 100 jobs and investing more than $18 million in Maine over the last 5 years. The PPAs will greatly enhance ORPC's ability to attract the additional investment needed to complete the project's build-out over the next 4 years. This also means that the significant economic development benefits ORPC has already created in Washington County will expand dramatically going forward.
ORPC is leading the charge, or one of the industry leaders, to tap into that resource and make tidal energy technology a viable commercial industry. So the Tigen, as we call it, helps us advance the technical, but also the operational environmental goals of the industry, and is building the capacity to develop, manufacture, deploy new ocean power technologies here in the United States. So once again, we're reclaiming the title of world leader in clean energy technology.
Occurred on March 20th, 2012, when we installed the 93,000-pound bottom support frame. The weather was superb, and our general contractor, Perry Marine Construction of Eastport, was ready to go after press rehearsing the operation with their crew, including the crane operator and hardhead divers. Timing was everything for this installation, since it had to be done in a 40-minute window of time at low slack time. Everything went off as planned, with the bottom support frame planted exactly on the ocean floor where we wanted it. We couldn't have done it without the hard work of PMC and 40 other local contractors. Once the bottom support frame was on the ocean floor, the hardhead divers went down to provide final guidance and check that everything was as it should be.
Plan for Washington County, the Lubbock Eastport area, and thank ORPC for working with us, and I'm really happy to help them with this project forward. It's really exciting for me to discuss my teenage daughter and some of her classmates that you can do anything you want with your lives. And yes, it is possible to have world-class technology here in Washington County, and that's what we're looking at.
Next on the agenda was installing the underwater power and data cables from where the device would be located in Cobscombe Bay to the offshore station at Bay. This involves splicing the bundled cables and putting them on the reels used to feed them to the installation plow.
Thank you.
cables were towed by the Eastport Port Authority and the cables were buried beneath the seafloor. This involved making a very tricky 90-degree turn along the route. Divers were used to monitor and guide the installation process. Although sections of rocky bottom precluded us from burying all of the bundle cables, the installation was deemed an overwhelming success. ORPC power systems are simple, robust, and modular, so they can be adapted to work in almost any potential application. They produce no gas or liquid emissions, create no noise issues, and do not interfere with natural water landscapes, navigation, or water recreation. ORPC has three specifically designed power systems. The TIGEN power system, shown here, is designed for shallow to medium depth tidal sites. The OPGEN power system, for use in deep
has been
tremendous, tremendous additions to this community. Everything they ever said that they were going to do on behalf of this community, within this community, for this community, in partnership with this community, they have done. In today's day and age, sometimes that's hard to find. Honesty and integrity in a business that truly cares. This is where we need to thank you, ORPC. Because in a community, in a region, in a state that often struggles to figure out where its tomorrows are going to come from, it takes businesses just like you. It takes visionaries just like you to show up, make us believe, give us something to believe in, and deliver. And today,
come on back in about 15 minutes.